Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the second session of the Contaminated Sediments, New Tools and Approaches for In-Situ Remediation Internet Web Seminar Series, sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. I'm Justin Crane with Superfund Research Program Contractor MDB Incorporated, and I will be the technical moderator for today's session. We will get started in just a few moments. While we wait for others to log on, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to the seminar-specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included short bio sketches of the presenters and moderator. Please note the presenters' email addresses are hot-linked on that page in case you have any questions after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, your phones were placed on mute when you joined the call. We will have question and answer sessions, at which point you can take your phone off mute. We ask that phone participants keep their phones on mute during the question and answer sessions unless you are asking a question. To unmute your phone during the question and answer session, you will need to dial *6. You may also need to press your phone's mute button if you have previously put yourself on mute. After you ask your questions, please place your phone back on mute by pressing *6 or using your phone's mute button. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. By now, those of you participating via the phone lines should have the presentation open and should be on slide 1. All of those participating via the internet should have clicked on the Go To Session icon near the bottom of the page and should be on slide 1 of the presentation. As explained on slide 2, the main page contains the slides above which you will find navigation icons. Internet participants may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide and need not wait until the question answer period to submit a question. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the question and answer session. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we will try to help you troubleshoot the problem. The presenters will be announcing the number of the slides to which they are moving. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide, or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. At the end of the presentations, we will walk you through our links page, where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentations. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. In the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Past web seminars are available on the CLUIN website and are also accessible via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Program, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information Archives and the new SRP Research Brief podcast. With that, we are ready to start the session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute and, again, do not put us on hold. At this time, I would like to introduce our moderator, Steve Ells. Steve is the leader of the sediments team in EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. He has been at EPA for over 30 years, spending the last 23 in the Superfund program. Steve is a recognized expert in contaminated sediments, ecological risk assessment, and remedy selection. He champions the use of risk-based decision-making and was lead author of the Principles for Managing Contaminated Sediment Risks at Hazardous Waste Sites and led the development of Contaminated Sediment Remediation Guide for Hazardous Waste Sites. Steve is the chair of the Contaminated Sediments Technical Advisory Group, which is evaluating the site investigations and remedy selection process at 14 of the most complex Superfund sediment sites. Steve also chairs the interagency group that seeks collaboration on sediment research projects. Steve received his BS in biology from Villanova University and his MS in fisheries biology from the University of Connecticut. Thank you for joining us, Steve, and I will now turn the time over to you.
Thanks, Justin. Our first speaker today is Dr. Upal Ghosh. Dr. Ghosh is an associate professor and graduate program director at the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. His research explores fundamental process mechanisms that control contaminant fate in soils, sediments, and aquatic environments. His research uses multidisciplinary tools to investigate exposure and bioavailability of organic contaminants to benthic organisms. His recent work explored the use of absorbent amendments to sediments to reduce their bioavailability of contaminants such as PCBs, PAHs, dioxins, heavy metals, and methylmercury. The technology is currently being demonstrated at several Superfund sites. Dr. Ghosh has an MS and PhD in Civil Environmental Engineering from the University of Buffalo and a Bachelor's in Chemical Engineering from the Indian Institute of Technology in Bombay. Before joining the University of Maryland, Dr. Ghosh worked at Carnegie Mellon University as a postdoc fellow and at Stanford as a research assistant. Dr. Ghosh, it's up to you. Start your seminar, please.
Thank you, Steve. I hope my mute is off. Can you all hear me?
Yep, we can.
Okay, that's great. Thank you, everyone, for participating in this webinar. And I'm going to give an overview of emerging technology for in-situ sediment remediation that we have been working on for about a decade now. And this work has been moving through lab-scale demonstrations, modeling, and onto pilot-scale studies. So what I'm going to do today is give an overview of this process over the last 10 years or so that we have been working on sediment remediation and looking at understanding contaminant bioavailability in sediments and how we can manage bioavailability by adding sorbent amendments into sediments. So I'm moving on to slide number 4 here in the combined slides, which shows a picture of a wetland with me and a colleague on a boat. And this is a this picture illustrates the challenge we often face in contaminated sediment remediation, which involves understanding the impact that we may have on the ecosystem for a sensitive, ecologically sensitive site like this one, which has vegetation and life flourishing, but also has issues with toxic organic chemicals or mercury that may be accumulating in the food chain and causing ecological harm. So the challenge for us is to think about technologies that can remediate sites like this without causing greater harm or overall net environmental damage in the process of remedy. And I'm sure many of you who work at sites are challenged by these types of situations. So when we started looking at these scenarios, one of the basic questions we started asking was, What's our fundamental understanding of how these contaminants behave in sediments, how they are taken up in the food chain, and how these contaminants are bound up in the sediment phase and how they get accumulated in organisms that are present in the sediment. So early on, our work looked at understanding where and how chemicals bind in the sediment phase. And when I say chemicals here, we are focusing primarily on hydrophobic organic chemicals like PCBs, PAHs, pesticides, things like dioxins and so forth. So if you go to slide number 5, we started looking at some of these sediments, and when we tried to understand sediments, very quickly we realized that it's not a homogeneous matrix that we are trying to describe, but it's a composite material made up of tens or hundreds of different types of particles. And these particles can be mineral grains, like sand particles. And what's of greater relevance for hydrophobic chemicals are the types of organic materials that are present. And the reason that's important is organic surfaces provide the hydrophobic interfaces to which hydrophobic chemicals like to bind. So when we look at these sediments closely, we find... So this, that's the picture here on the left in slide number 5 shows particle scale image of sediments coming from Hunters Point Navy Shipyard. This is one of the sites that we worked early on about 10 years ago. And when you look at that carefully, you see that these organic particles are composed either of materials that came from vegetative type origin decaying biomass, which forms the natural organic matter content of the sediment. But we also have in these environments, especially for environments that are impacted by industrial activities, a lot of black carbon. And black carbon are materials that may be coming from some kind of combustion source like soot, or coal, coke-based materials, and also charcoal that could be coming from human activity or also from natural forest fires. And we find that for PCBs and PAHs, when chemicals are bound to these black carbon materials naturally present in the sediments, the availability of those chemicals are greatly reduced compared to the same chemicals absorbed to natural organic materials that are also present in the sediments. And we looked at understanding those differences between the sediment particle types by looking at partitioning into the water phase from these materials and also biooptake in organisms. So if you go to slide number 6, which shows water partitioning of model compound here, which is phenanthrene, one of the PAHs, for various organic carbons. So what we have in this figure in slide number 6 is the various organic types that we might encounter in sediments. On the right extreme are natural organic materials that may be present in sediments like cellulose, lignin, algae, oxidized humic acids, and so forth. And as we go towards the left, we get into more black carbon materials like coal, charcoal, soot carbon, and the leftmost is the activated carbon. And what we are showing here on the y-axis is the log of the partition constant, that's partitioning between that organic material and water phase. Higher the value, greater the partitioning into the solid phase. And this is log scale, so this is 10 raised to 6 or 7, whatever the value is in the y-axis there. And that gives us an understanding of how these chemicals are bound in the sediment phase or into the water phase. And as you go from the right to the left, you see quite a range of these partition constants. So the black carbon is about 2 to 3 orders of magnitude more sorptive for these chemicals than the natural organic matter. And that plays out in terms of bioavailability of these chemicals to organisms that may be coming in contact with the material. So some of the early fundamental studies that we conducted looked at bioavailability of PCBs and PAHs associated with these different types of materials. This is work done by a PhD student at Stanford, Pamela McLeod, and this was published in 2004, where she took different types of organic materials, starting from diatoms, which are the natural food for our model organism, which is the macoma here, the clam, and wood, char, anthracite, peat, coke, and activated carbon. So she took all these different types of particles, ground them to the size that these clams would feed on, and we added labeled benzoylpyrene and carbon 14 level PCB, a tetrachloro PCB, into these different types of organic particles and made the clams feed on them. And then what she's tracking here is how much of that radioactivity associated with the benzoylpyrene or the PCB is assimilated in the clam tissue versus how much passes through the clam gut into the feces. And then you can calculate what's called the absorption efficiency, what fraction of total PCB or the PAH passes through the gut without being assimilated in the tissue versus how much is assimilated. So for diatoms, you see very high levels of assimilation. And the primary reason for that is diatom is the food and the organism is trying to extract carbon from the diatoms. It gets totally digested and disintegrated. And most of the PCBs or the PAHs associated with the diatoms or even the wood get assimilated in the clam. However, if you look at activated carbon, which is a strong adsorbent for these two chemicals, the PCBs or the PAH associated with the carbon passes through the gut, mostly 98% passes through the gut without being absorbed by the clam. So what that indicated to us is that the high partitioning of these chemicals into the strong sorbent phase makes them less accessible even when these particles pass through the gut of an organism, benthic organism like clam. We also looked at another freshwater organism, so that's moving on to slide number 8 here. And this is a freshwater oligochaeta, which is used as a model organism for measuring bioaccumulation in freshwater sediments. And in this experiment, we did it a little differently. We took clean sediments and added PCBs to the clean sediment directly, or we took the same PCB amount, added it to activated carbon, and then added the spiked activated carbon into sediments. So we have two different ways we spiked the sediment with PCBs, directly with PCBs, or PCBs added to carbon and then added to sediments. And then expose these organisms to these two differently spiked sediments. And what you see is very high uptake of PCBs from sediments that are directly spiked, where the PCBs are associated with the native sediment. Whereas when the PCBs are associated with the activated carbon that has been added to the sediment, then the bio uptake is less by more than 90%. So these types of tests give us this understanding that we would rather have these chemicals associated with a black carbon particle than with natural organic materials, association with which is weak, and chemicals become easily taken up by the organisms. So the picture that emerges for us in terms of understanding bioavailability is shown in slide number 9, that the sediment is composed of different types of materials which are binding these hydrophobic chemicals, going from natural organic materials on the left to soot or coal or coke to the right. And the different pathways of uptake into the benthic organism, either from direct ingestion or through diffusive exchange through the pore water, through the skin, are impacted strongly by how these chemicals are adsorbed to these materials. So if the chemicals are associated primarily with natural organic matter in natural sediments, then the bioavailability is high, whereas if we have sediments where the chemicals are associated with strong sorbents present either naturally or added as an additive, as a part of a treatment, then both of these pathways of uptake through ingestion or through direct diffusion through the skin is lower in the case of black carbon. And that communicates up the food chain through fish and higher animals in terms of the food chain contamination. So we, based on these lab studies, we came up with the idea of being able to influence the bio-uptake of chemicals in the field through two types of scenarios, and that's shown in slide number 10 here. So on the top here is a cartoon showing contaminated sediments. Those circles are my natural sediment particles with PCBs in them. And the squiggly red lines are the worms that are present in the sediment. So if I'm a PCB molecule there in that natural sediment with PCBs in it, as a PCB molecule which is hydrophobic, I'm looking for hydrophobic matrices to partition into, which is the natural organic matter in the sediment or the fat or the lipid phase in these organisms that are present in the sediment. And if you look at some of these values for partitioning into organic carbon or partitioning into lipid, you find that the affinity of PCBs and pHs into lipid or natural organic matter are about the same. And that's why you get BSAF, biosediment accumulation factors, for benthic organisms close to 1, and which indicates that the partitioning between the sediment organic matter and the lipid phase is close. Now, if we look at the cartoon on the lower right, where I've added black particles into the top layer of sediments, which is the region in the sediment where most of these benthic organisms might be residing in, then we have added a strong adsorbent phase, which now competes with other adsorbents that are already present in the sediment. And a PCB molecule would rather get into the black carbon phase than into the sediment organic matter or the lipid phase of the organisms. So we have a greater greater competition now for the same molecules, which has been caused by the presence of this strongly adsorbent carbon that has been introduced. So the PCB molecules would now rather adsorb onto the black carbon particles, and so the uptake in these benthic organisms would be reduced. The other way of doing this might be to create a new layer of sediment on top of the contaminated sediment, and the new layer could be a thin cap of sand or other clean sediments, which has now been amended with a strong adsorbent phase, which creates a barrier for the chemicals to get into the zone where the organisms are residing. So there can be two ways now we can try to engineer this in the field, where we either change the geochemistry of the top bioactive zone of sediments by amending carbon directly into existing sediments, or create a new layer of clean sediments on top, which has been amended with the carbon. So with these ideas now, we went on to doing tests with sediments that have been collected from the field, which are contaminated with PCBs. And one of the first set of studies we did was supported by the EPA Great Lakes National Program Office, and we looked at four sediments collected from areas of concern sites in the Great Lakes. And so I'm moving on to slide number 11 here, which shows one of those experiments that we did where we took contaminated sediments from the field and treated them in different ways and with activated carbon as the adsorbent of choice for PCBs, and looked at bio-uptake in this freshwater Aleutite, the lumbriculus variegatus. So one of the things we studied in this initial experiment was to look at different modes of adding carbon into sediments. So ideally one would like to take activated carbon and mix it very well in the top bioactive zone. The other, and that can be a little challenging for a field situation, for a large site. So we also wanted to look at what happens if you are able to do an initial mixing for 2 minutes and then let natural mixing processes take over, or add carbon as a thin layer and do no mixing, but allow the organisms to do the mixing, carry out the mixing for us. So those are the different types of treatments we looked at with multiple replicates in these 400 ml beakers with filled with sediment, overlying water, and these organisms added to do the bioaccumulation studies. If you move on to slide number 12, which shows sample picture of what it looks like from the side of one of these beakers, when we have added the carbon as a thin layer on top of sediments. Now these organisms that we are studying, these are the freshwater oligochaetes, which have this unique behavior of burying their head down into sediments like an earthworm, but their tail sticks out. And what they do is they feed with their mouth into the sediment and excrete from their tail end, which is in the water column. And so they are turning the sediment around and depositing a layer of feces, which is basically processed sediment, on top of the sediment layer. So if you start off with a layer of thin layer of carbon on top of that sediment, very soon, this is a picture that is taken 2 days after placing that thin layer of carbon, you see that that layer is already covered with feces that has been processed by these worms. And these worms, you can see on this image here, some of these worms that are close to the edge of the glass, that their head is down in the sediments and they're releasing the feces on top. And in the process of doing this burrowing activity, they're actually ending up carrying the carbon down into their burrows and causing a mixing of that carbon into the top layer of sediment, which is the bioactive zone where these organisms live. So depending on the physiology of these organisms and their burrowing behavior, one would see different types of mixing activity when you have in the real sediments, and that would also depend on the density of these organisms that are present. But the effects of these worms doing the mixing was quite interesting, and that's shown in the next slide, slide number 13. So if we place the carbon as a thin layer on top of sediments or do various types of mixing of the carbon, we see slightly different results in terms of biooptic reduction. So what we're looking at here is reduction in uptake compared to sediments that have not been treated with carbon. And the percentages there are in the range of 70 to 94% reduction in biooptake compared to the control which had no carbon. And we see a slightly less reduction in the range of 70 to 77% in the cases where we don't mix the carbon intimately into the sediments, and about 90% reduction or so when the carbon is mixed into the sediment. And we also see that there is a little greater benefit of using finer carbon, and that is primarily due to better mass transfer. If you go on to the next slide, number 14, it summarizes multiple studies that have been of similar nature that have been carried out by various researchers, by us, by several students at Stanford, and also a research group at Norway at the Norwegian Geotechnical Institute, where people looked at PCBs, PAHs, DDT, dioxins for various types of sediments, freshwater sediments, marine sediments. And the two figures here, the first one on the left shows reduction in pore water concentration of these chemicals, and those range from 70 to 90% reductions after amending with activated carbon. And if you look at the right panel, that shows reduction in biooptake in benthic organism, which could be a marine amphipod or a clam or polychaete or a freshwater oligochaete. And those reductions are mostly in the range of, again, 70 to 90%, except for one of the experiments where little reduction was seen for PAHs in a marine worm. So, and these have all been published in nine publications in the last 7 or 8 years. So that gives us a summary of some of the studies that have been done in the lab to look at bioavailability reduction as a function of carbon amendment. And the dose of carbon in all these studies are typically in the range of half to one times the native TOC of sediment. And that's the kind of dose that has, and several of these studies looked at a dose response, looking at different doses of carbon, but typically in the range of half to one times the TOC of the sediment. So with these results from the laboratory, the next thing we wanted to do was to be able to quantitatively describe the processes that are responsible for the reduction that we see in bioavailability. So this is work that was done by a PhD student here, Sui-Li Sun, looking at the different mass transfer processes that result in the reduction in biooptake. So slide number 15 now shows the major processes that we need to keep track of to quantitatively describe and be able to predict long-term how these bioavailability reductions might play out in real sediments. So when we look at these processes, we have to describe these different compartments that are present in sediment. So in terms of the sediments, when we look at contaminants like PCBs and PAHs coming off from sediment, and we do these desorption kinetic studies, we find that we can describe the desorption kinetics by looking at a fast dissolving fraction that comes off the sediments readily, and that has been related to the bioavailable fraction in the sediments. And we find that in native sediments, a certain fraction of contaminants come off much slowly, and that's the recalcitrant, less available fraction. And we can describe that by doing independent tests looking at desorption kinetics of PCBs or PAHs from sediments. So on the top, we have described these different particle types, fast PCB-releasing particles and slow PCB-releasing particles from sediments. And then we can, if we add activated carbon, that brings in a third type of particle in the sediment, which has a strong sorption capacity. Now, the key aspect here is the mass transfer of PCBs or PAHs from native sediment particles onto the activated carbon particles, but that's mediated through the water phase or the pore water phase, which is the conduit or the medium through which the mass transfer takes place. And that's the phase in which we can also measure the concentration at any given point of time. The other compartment here of relevance is the organism. In this case, we are modeling lumbriculus. And the lumbriculus takes up PCBs either through dermal adsorption through the pore from the pore water or through ingestion of these different types of particles. And it can also eliminate some of these PCBs that it takes up. So what we were able to do is independently measure each of these kinetic processes. We measured desorption kinetics of sediments. We looked at adsorption characteristics of activated carbon and modeled adsorption into activated carbon as a porous adsorbent media. We looked at the dermal adsorption of PCBs into the lumbriculus by exposing the animals to different aqueous concentrations of PCBs in carefully managed flow-through cells. And this is all described in that paper, Sun et al., ESNT 2009. And the full citation of the paper is in one of the last slides of my talk that you can refer to. And to give an example of, let's see here. So the next slide here, number 16, is actually the model which shows the concentration in the organism CB as a function of time is a function of uptake through the dermal uptake mechanism. And then the one in the summation is the uptake through the ingestion phase, ingestion of the organisms from the different particle types I, and the elimination from the organism. And we can couple that with the PCB interparticle mass transfer model, which looks at the mass transfer between the fast, slow, and the activated carbon particles. So we combine all that and develop a model that can then predict mass transfer into the organism while all this mass transfer is happening between the particle types. And then we can look at long-term predictions. Just to give you an example of one of these experiments, we looked at measuring the ingestion rate and extraction efficiency of PCBs in these organisms by taking advantage of the unique behavior of this organism where they burrow their head into the mud, feed on the sediments, and release the feces on the top of the water column. So what we did was in these beakers, if we put a thin layer of clean sand on top of the sediment after the organisms have burrowed in, the tails are sticking out of the clean sand layer and are depositing the feces on top of the clean sand layer, which can then be collected, measured to calculate the rate of feces generation, which is also the ingestion rate. And we can also measure PCBs in the feces versus PCBs in the ingested sediment and calculate what fraction is actually extracted in the organism. So we measured these parameters independently and then plugged it into the model and looked at predictions of what happens if we put a certain amount of activated carbon into these sediments and compared those with our measurements. So if you go to slide number 18 here, there are two figures. The one on the left is before treatment, and what we are seeing here in the two axes are the x-axis at the bottom is measured PCB concentration in micrograms per gram tissue, and the y-axis is predicted PCB concentration in micrograms per gram tissue, so model versus measured values, and this is even without activated carbon. We are testing if the model can predict what the organisms are taking up. And the values that you see here are for three different sediments, Grass River and two other sediments. And concentration ranges in the sediments are about 3 ppm to the highest was about 60 or 70 ppm in sediments. And different congeners that we are measuring here, they seem to agree very well, lying on that 45-degree 1:1 line, showing that the model is able to do a reasonable job of predicting what the organisms would uptake based on sort of very basic properties of mass transfer between the sediment particles and into the organism. If we add activated carbon to this mix, and as you see there in that figure in the inset, we have the different dosage of carbon added to each of those sediments, and the doses are different because they are all half the native TOC of sediment. So the native TOC is different in these sediments, so we added different amounts. But the real competition is between the native organic carbon and the activated carbon that we are adding. So that ratio of 50% or half the native TOC as carbon is the same for all of those three sediments. And here you see that after adding carbon, the concentrations have moved down in concentration value, but the correlation remains quite strong. That is, the measured and the predicted are around are clustered around that 45 degree line. So the details of the modeling exercise is was published in 2009 in ESNT. Once we have this model that we feel comfortable with, now we can do long-term predictions and look at different doses of carbon. So if you look at slide number 19 now, it shows PCB concentration in tissue, micrograms per gram, in the y-axis, and the x-axis is exposure time in days, going up to 10 years now. And note that the axes are split in the time and also in scale on the y-axis for concentration. So untreated sediment, the organisms quickly equilibrate to a high level of PCB in the tissue. But as we add carbon, activated carbon into sediment, this is just one PCB molecule, PCB49. Two times the TOC, half the TOC, one times TOC, and going up to five times the TOC of sediment. As we increase the dose of carbon, we see a progressive decrease in biouptake in these organisms. And around the value of one times TOC or so is where we seem to see a big impact of the carbon. Beyond that, it still increases, the additional benefit may be reduced. So about greater than 90% reduction of PCB uptake in about 1 year with one times TOC dose of carbon in sediments, and it progressively goes lower with time as the PCB molecules, especially the larger PCB molecules, are able to diffuse into the carbon with time. So that's what the modeling predicts in terms of long-term mass transfer. So with these lab studies and modeling results, we then moved on to thinking about how this might play out in a field scale. So if you go to slide number 20 now, it shows a conceptual model that we have in our mind, and it's important to get the conceptual model right to make sure that in-situ remedy with solvent amendment into sediments would work in the site. And we think at this time that it may be suitable for sites that fit this type of conceptual model where ongoing sources have been controlled. So if you have a river or a lake, as depicted here, the primary contamination of the food chain is happening from exposure to the legacy sediments that have been deposited in the past, and not from ongoing sources that are coming downstream into the river. So here we have contaminated sediments which are providing the contaminants that are accumulating in these benthic organisms, and fish which may be feeding on these benthic organisms are then picking up these contaminants and passing it up the food chain. Or we have a diffusive flux of PCBs into the water column from the sediment phase, which are being picked up by the plankton or other things that are in the water column, and then getting into the fish. So in that scenario, if we now add activated carbon to the top bioactive zone of sediments, which is impacting these two pathways of exposure, if you go to slide number 21, that shows a layer of carbon in this cartoon in that benthic zone where organisms are present, and is also the zone from which much of the flux of PCBs from sediment in the water column might be taking place. That if the PCBs are now bound up in the strong adsorbent matrix, that reduces the uptake in the benthic organisms, which reduces the uptake in the fish. And also the flux into the water column is reduced because the pore waters are greatly suppressed now in terms of freely dissolved PCB concentrations. So that's the scenario that we are working with, and we don't have other arrows coming from, you know, major inputs with stormwater outfalls into this river or down, PCBs primarily coming downstream, you know, from upstream sources. Then we may have brought about a change in the primary uptake pathways into the fish and into the food chain. So with that conceptual idea in mind, we were able to plan out several pilot scale studies in the last about 4 or 5 years. And those are summarized here in slide number 22. So the first one was conducted in a tidal mudflat in San Francisco Bay. This was a study that was led by Stanford University through a ESCCP project with Dick Luthie as the co-PI, and I also participated in that project. And so this is a site which is contaminated with PCBs and is considered to be one of the hotspots of PCBs in San Francisco Bay. And two different types of equipment were used to deliver carbon into the top 1 foot of sediments. And the results from this study have been published in a couple of publications that came out in the last few years. The next one, Grass River, New York, is a river environment, 15 feet of water, and sediments were treated with activated carbon using different equipment. And I'll spend some more time describing that study in the next few slides. The other studies, there were two studies that were carried out by colleagues at Norway in a Norwegian harbor, Trondheim, and fjord in Norway, which was done in 2009. And these are ongoing pilot-scale studies in a slightly different type of environment. The number four there shows Bailey Creek, Virginia, USA. This is work that has been supported by the NIEHS Superfund Research Program, where we took carbon and pelletized that into a form that was easy to deliver over grass and vegetation in the wetland. And this is an ongoing study looking at PCB bioaccumulation in organisms after amending carbon into sediments. And Charlie Menzie will talk more about that application and also an ongoing application this week at Aberdeen Proving Grounds in a similar type of environment but with sediments contaminated with mercury and metal mercury. So with that, let me go on to describing some of the results from the pilot scale demonstration in Grass River, New York. So this is a Superfund site that is undergoing investigations in terms of what might be a appropriate remedy for the site. And as part of several pilot studies, activated carbon was used as a for a pilot demonstration to see the effectiveness in a river environment. So this is an environment where we have a relatively slow-flowing river, and the depth of water is about 14 to 15 feet. And there are several participants involved in this large study that was conducted in 2006, and we have been monitoring that over the years. Alcoa supported the study, and EPA also supported the study. We were the technical lead and helped with a lot of the measurements. Stanford University was also participating, Anchor, Brennan, Tetra Tech. We got a lot of inputs from various stakeholders in this Superfund site, which really allowed us to design and perform this study in an efficient way. So to give you a description here, the application was done in the middle of the river, in the main channel, with the L-shaped silt curtain installed to reduce any weed suspension flowing down the river. Equipment was mobilized in barges. The dose of carbon was half the TOC plus a safety factor, which amounted to close to 4% by weight dry sediment. And water column PCBs were measured downstream to monitor any impacts of the water column during application. There were several types of applications that were performed. And if you go to the next slide, slide number 24, the two main pieces of equipment that were designed and built by Brennan to conduct the study are shown. The primary instrument is on the right, which is a 7 by 12 foot inverted steel box with tillers inside and injection nozzles that injected a slurry of carbon. The idea is that this box would sit on the sediment surface, enclosing an area in which the carbon will be injected and mixed into the top layer of sediment. And then the sediment that's resuspended during that mixing settles down, and then the box is moved to the next spot. The other one is a tank sled, a series of injection tanks that injected carbon into the top few inches of sediment. Several types of monitoring elements were incorporated in the study, which included measurement of carbon in cores to understand where the carbon is with time. We did bio-optic measurements in the field and in the lab, equilibrium measurements of aqueous PCBs, desorption kinetics, benthic community assessments, erosion potential, and recently we have been doing studies to look at any impact of carbon on aquatic plant growth. So I'll walk you through some of these results that have come out of this study over the last 3 years of monitoring post-amendment. So the amendment was done in the fall of 2006, and we have done these measurements in 2007, 8, and 9, so 3 years, each of the 3 years after application. So what's shown here in slide number 26 is percent carbon in sediment as a function of sediment depth in one of these treatment areas, the mixed tiller treatment area. And what you see is that if you look at 2007, much of the carbon, the highest dose of carbon, was seen in the top 0 to 1.5 inches of sediment. And we have to recognize here that in these field measurements, we see a lot of variability in carbon from one location to another. So the error bars are large. And that's simply because of the local heterogeneity that we ended up seeing in the distribution of the carbon. But one big picture that emerges from this measurement is the distinction that you see from going from 2007 to 2009. So in 2009, the peak of the concentration of carbon in sediments has moved down to the zone of 3 to 4.5 inches. And the top layer of sediment, 0 to 5 inches in 2009, has very little carbon. And what that indicates to us is that there is sediments that are being deposited on the site, and the carbon-treated layer is getting buried down into sediments, deeper into sediments with time. And this is what we would expect. We would like to see that the carbon-treated layer is covered with new sediment, which hopefully should be clean sediment if all the ongoing sources have been controlled. Which may not be so for a pilot study where the rest of the contaminated site has not been treated yet. So in this study, the deposited sediments do have PCBs, but if this were a full-scale application in the whole river, one would expect the new sediment that's deposited on top of the carbon-treated layer would be clean sediments. Let's go to slide number 26, and this shows a picture of the deployment of caged worms in these treated and untreated sites. So we had, the way we designed our measurements, we had samples that we measured in the treated sites, and we also had designated an upstream background site which was not treated with carbon. And for each of these sites, then we took sediment samples each year, brought some of them back to the lab to do the traditional bioaccumulation study and the other studies like equilibrium and desorption studies. But we also took the same sediment and put them back in these cages at the time of sampling with worms back into the site. and to do an in-situ exposure of these worms to sediments that have been collected from those sites. So let's go to slide number 28, which shows results of PCBs in Lumbricula's variegatus in in-situ exposures. So these are worms that were put in cages, put back into the sediment, either in the treated zone or the untreated zones. And I'm showing you values here of the same measurement done in the exact same way in 2006, which is before application of carbon. And those are the blue bars. And we're showing here the total PCBs. We measured about 90 different conunits, and what's shown here is the sum of all those 90. 2007, 8, and 9, which is 1, 2, and 3 years post-treatment. So the bars in blue show the high values which were existing for in 2006 before carbon amendment in tissue. Now the three sets of bars with BG1, BG2, and BG3 as labels in the x-axis are the background upstream sites which did not receive carbon. So first thing we see here is that with time, the background site is showing lower accumulation of PCBs. So over the 3 years, we see about 46% reduction in PCB bioaccumulation in these in-situ tests at these background sites for these worms. But if you look at the mixed treatment sites, the reductions are greater, and the overall reduction in 2009 for the mixed treated sites with activated carbon is about 92%. So much higher reduction in the treated sites compared to the untreated background sites. If you go to the next slide, which looks very similar, these are results from lab exposures with the same sediments collected from the same sites, background sites and the mixed treated sites. But these sediments were brought back to the lab and exposed to worms in beakers using the standard bioaccumulation study protocols. And a similar picture here, although we see a slightly higher reduction in the background sites, to about 80% reduction in the background sites when we do these tests in the lab. But we also see a slightly greater reduction in the carbon-treated sites, going up to about 95% reduction in bioaccumulation over these 3 years of treatment. So what the picture that emerges here for us is that over the 3 years, consistently we are seeing a much higher reduction in bioaccumulation of PCBs in the range of greater than 90% in the carbon-treated sediment sites. If you go to slide number 30 now, this is these are results from the other types of treatments that were conducted in the field. The one in which carbon was applied using the tine sled, and the unmixed tiller, where the tilling equipment was used to apply the carbon slurry, but the tillers were not turned on. So the sediment was actually not mixed with the carbon, but the carbon was added as a thin layer on top. And in these two types of treatments also, we see in the same range of reduction, 93% overall in 2009. There are some differences in the different PCB homologs. The dominant homologs for this site in the sediment was tri- and tetrachloro-PCBs. But if you go to slide number 31, it shows PCB uptake reduction in in-situ measurements for the different PCB homologs compared to the 2006 data. And early on, we saw greater reduction for the lower chlorinated PCBs compared to the higher chlorinated PCBs. But if you look at the 2009 data, some of the higher chlorinated PCBs are also showing greater reduction in bioaccumulation. So one of the things we realized is that in this field study, we ended up getting slightly different doses of carbon in these different sites where we took samples for measurement later. So we ended up having a dose response study because each of these samples had slightly different carbon amounts that we ended up getting. So if you go to slide number 32, what we did here is plotted the percent reduction of bioaccumulation in worms as a function of carbon dose, because each of these samples had a different dose of carbon, typically in the range of 1 to 10%, a few going higher than that, just because we ended up getting more carbon in some of these locations. So we have plotted here the different types of treatment, the mixed tiller treatment where carbon was mixed into the top layer, unmixed tiller and the time sled for the different years, 2007, 8, and 9. So what you see is somewhat of a dose response here where higher the dose of carbon, greater the reduction in PCB uptake compared to 2006. And basically what the big message here is that we see greater than 90% reduction for all treatment sites in 2009 for carbon dose greater than 4%. So this is 4% by dry weight, which would be less if we look at wet weight sediment. Plotted in the same way for aqueous equilibrium, we see greater reduction in the aqueous equilibrium concentrations, greater than 95% or 98% reduction of aqueous equilibrium concentration once the dose of carbon is greater than 4%. So both these measurements looking at PCB uptake in worms and PCB partitioning into the aqueous phase are greatly reduced when carbon is added in the field. A quick other measurement that we did, we'll use passive samplers to measure PCBs in the water column and also PCBs in the sediment surface, where these passive samplers were deployed along with these cages, either at the bottom of the cage, which sensed the aqueous concentration of PCBs in the sediment surface right adjacent to the water column, and also higher up in the water column, going up to 2 feet in the water column. So these are aqueous concentrations in nanograms per liter for total PCBs. So if you look at the top figure background site, by the way, that's PhD student Barbara Beckingham doing the deployments in the field in the picture there. In the background site, what you see is a little higher concentration of PCBs, aqueous PCBs, right at the sediment surface, and the concentration in the water column is in the range of 10 to 30 nanograms per liter. And so the conceptual model is the PCB concentrations are higher in the pore water in the sediments and it's diffusing up into the water column. If you look at the carbon-treated sites in all of these years after application of carbon, you see a depressed concentration in the sediment pore water right at the sediment-water interface, which indicates that we have created a situation here where the water column has more aqueous PCBs, freely dissolved PCBs, than what's present in the sediment surface. So that's what one would like to see, that the sediment is no longer a source to the water column in this scenario. Quick summary here of results from learnings from the pilot scale studies in slide number 35, that these pilot scale studies are now giving us the confidence that carbon can be applied in a large scale and it remains in place after 3 years of placement. And we saw that with these coring studies where we measured carbon in sediments and found that new deposit was burning these carbon-treated sediments into the deeper layers of sediment. We see reductions in pore water levels and desorption. We see reductions in tissue PCB levels. And over time, the carbon-amended sediment is covered with new sediments. I didn't get into the benthic community studies, but for three of these sites where we did pilot-scale application and we monitored benthic community over time, we saw no major shift in benthic community as a function of carbon application. So with that, let me continue with the big picture here with some cost figures. So if you're looking at 5% carbon in the top 4 inches of sediment, this is in slide number 36, and that amounts to about 6 pounds per square yard, and per acre cost of dose of carbon would be about 30,000 pounds. And the cost of price of bulk carbon is in the range of $1 a pound or maybe a little higher than that. So we're looking at about 30 to 40 $6,000 per acre in terms of carbon cost. Application cost will depend on the method of application, and that's being figured out through these pilot studies now. So several promising considerations here is application in small increments over time to incorporate the carbon into newly deposited sediments over a few years. That will also help in getting a more uniform distribution of carbon in the sediments, both spatially and also with depth. There's a promising alternative here of looking at using activated biochar from agricultural residue instead of coal-based activated carbon, which can provide an opportunity for carbon sequestration in addition to PCB sequestration, and looking at low-impact methods and low-cost methods of delivery. And we'll hear about a few approaches that might be feasible for delivery into sediments. Slide number 37 is a list of publications on in-situ amendments in the last decade, about 22 publications that you can look up or ask me if I can send you a copy. And I'd like to end with acknowledgments. Much of the work that I presented is has been done by PhD students and other master's students and postdocs in my group. Barbara Beckingham, especially for the work in Grass River, and Adam Grossman. Several collaborators and sponsors, including Alcoa for the Grass River work, DOD CERTIF and ESGCP programs, and Glencoe and the Superfund Research Program. With that, I'll be happy to take questions now or at the end of the session, whatever is appropriate. Thank you,
Thanks,
everyone.
Thanks, Shapal. Good talk. We've got time for a few questions now, and then after the next talk, assuming there's time, we can go back and you can ask questions of either presenter. So first, if we got some questions from the phone line, please go ahead and ask Dr. Ghosh your question.
This is Brett Thomas, EPA Region 4. One of the concerns for applying amendments like this, sorptive amendments, has been the question of saturation. And did you guys look at that at all with regard to, I know you applied the activated carbon as a function of the amount of organic carbon already in the sediment, but did you guys also look or consider how much contaminant was in the sediments and how much carbon it might take to actually sequester that over time?
Right, we did look into that, and the question of saturation really comes from, it needs to be thought through in terms of where are the PCBs coming from that needs to be absorbed into the carbon. Now, if it is an ongoing source of PCBs coming with the water column that is depositing on the sediments, that's going to be challenging. But if it is legacy deposits in sediments, and PCBs are already in the sediments that we have to deal with, then it's much easier to figure out how much carbon we need. And a couple of things that are useful to note here is that PCBs don't move much because the retardation is so strong that, for example, we don't talk about PCBs moving in a groundwater plume. So for that reason, PCBs tend to stay associated with sediments. And the calculations we have done, the amounts of carbon that we are adding here is far more than what one would need for equilibrium considerations. And the primary reason we are adding at the levels of 2 to 5% by weight of dry sediment is to account for not saturation with the PCBs themselves, but from the competition with other types of organics that compete for the same sites. So what ends up being a little more important than the PCBs that saturate the carbon is other organics that compete with PCBs and reduce the effectiveness of the carbon. So if we didn't have other types of organics present that compete with the PCBs for absorption, we'll be adding tenths of a percent activated carbon. Equilibrium considerations would tell us we need very, very little activated carbon because the softening capacity is 2 to 3 orders of magnitude higher than natural organic matter. So the way we are addressing that is by looking at sediments that have been treated with carbon in the field and taking them back after 3 years and 4 years back to the lab and measuring how much residual capacity is there in those carbons for adsorption of new PCBs. And what we are finding is that after 3 years or 4 years in the sediment, these activated carbons still have a huge capacity to absorb.
Great, thank you.
Thanks, Shafal. I'm going to take one question from online, and then we're going to go on to Dr. Birkin, and then hopefully with time, come back to you, Yupal. I got a question here from Kendra Colliar from the Navy in Silverdale, Washington. The question to you is, have you considered the negative effects of adding activated carbon to sensitive sites such as wetlands? If so, what are the negative effects, and do they outweigh the benefits of reducing the PCB content in the sediments?
We have looked at effects on benthic community. And for the pilot study that was done at San Francisco Bay, the one at Grass River, and the one at Fort Eustis, each of these sites, we measured benthic community before and after treatment with carbon. And the benthic community results change every year. And what we have been able to demonstrate for each of these three sites is that we don't see any negative effect of carbon addition. A much bigger impact of season or year in which we sampled. So we see changes that happen both in the treated sites and in the background's untreated sites, but we don't see any negative effect on the treated sites as a function of carbon. So that's been what we have, that's been the results that we have seen from these pilot scale studies for benthic community. Now, we haven't looked at plants, and that's something that we are starting to look at in a study that we are doing at that got added on recently for the work we are doing at Grass River, where we are looking at growth of submerged aquatic vegetation on the effect of carbon on the growth of growth and survival of vegetation. And we looked at different doses of carbon, and at the high dose of 5 to 7.5% of carbon, we see 100% survival, but then slightly reduced growth. And so that's something that we are trying to understand better in terms of plant growth if a certain type of carbon has an impact. For example, biomass-based carbons have been shown to enhance plant growth, but maybe activated carbon made from coal may have some impact on plant growth that we are trying to understand. But basically what we saw was that for all treatments, the plants grew more than 400%, but the growth was slightly lower at the highest doses of carbon. And we're trying to figure out if that's purely due to a dilution effect of carbon in sediments or if there's an active effect of carbon. And So basically for benthic community in terms of benthic organisms, invertebrates in the sediments, we see no effect. But in lab studies with plants, we see slower growth at a high dose of carbon for one of the plants that we have studied.
Okay, thanks, Yupal. At this time, I'm going to go on to our next presentation. It's going to be by Dr. Joel Birkin. His research efforts have focused on developing low-impact and natural treatment systems to improve water quality using sustainable remediation and green remediation techniques. He received his PhD from the University of Iowa, where he did research on phytoremediation. He's also done research at the National Environmental Research Institute in Denmark, and now is at the at Missouri University of Science and Technology, since 1997, where he is a professor and the interim director of the Environmental Research Center there. His research in phytoremediation of organic contaminants and his pioneering work in forensics have led to numerous publications and international recognition. He's also initiated research into the financial benefits of carbon credit training and the water footprint of biofuels that are being developed. Dr. Birkin, if you're ready to go, you can start your presentation.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve. And thanks, Upal. We originally planned on this and just kind of, I think, alphabetically had me first, and it makes a lot more sense because the work we're going to talk about here is largely based on Upal's work, and others have looked at sediment amendment, and we're simply looking at another mechanism of delivering that with less impact and a little bit more capability of reaching different profiles within the sediment. So this is a very logical development there, and I owe a big thanks to Upal for all the great work that made this possible and logical for us to endeavor upon. And you see the title there, so we're looking at new tools and approaches to actually deliver the remediation amendments. And in this case, we have focused largely on the activated carbon. We've done some work with iron, and we've also looked at liquid. So there's a variety of things that this technology could be applied to have a good outreach. To move on to slide 40, I'd like to first off thank what should be co-authors and support for this work. Dr. Kurt Elmore in the Geological Engineering Department here at Missouri S&T did a lot of the work at developing the first concepts of using water jets to remediate amendments. And then Greg Galecki and Dave Summers are in the water jet laboratory here on campus that made it possible for us to, again, endeavor upon something a little bit different there. And co-PI Danny Reibel at Austin really brought a lot of the sediment knowledge. This is a new research area for us, and also the technologies to do a sediment profiling with concentration. And the next group are the graduate students and undergraduate students who have helped out on the project. And, of course, thank the NIHS for their support and Heather Henry for doing a lot of great work at pulling us together and making the contacts between Danny, us, Upal, and others that are working within the sediment projects that are within the Superfund research program right now. So with all the thanks, and again, everything I present here was done by pretty much the people on this slide, so we'll move right into some of the work we've been doing and on to slide 41. So you see in slide 41 a conceptual schematic of the use of water jets to reach into the sediment profile, and one of the targets that we're looking at that's a little bit unique is trying to get to contaminated sediments at depth without great disturbance to the surface or the benthic community. And you can see there we've looked at placing different amendments, including liquid amendments, activated carbon, and zero-valent iron, which is a reductant that can react with a number of chlorinated compounds or oxidized contaminants that could be in the sediment profile. And the general approach there is to reduce the resuspension and the disturbance to the surface. We're not looking at anything new chemically or biologically, really. We're looking at using the existing methodologies, and it may lead to new approaches once we have the tools in place. And then one thing we're directly trying to measure is what the reduction is to direct benthic mortality due to the application method or recovery. And as you see from that slide, in a number of cases, the contaminated sediments have been overlain with clean sediments, and there may be interest in trying to remediate those sediments at depth, but the question would be, is the disturbance of the overlying capped sediments worth the approach? And we hope to provide a mechanism that could make that viable. And that's what we'll cover today. So moving on to slide 41, or 42 here, the preliminary look that we'll cover first looked at using a liquid injectment. We've essentially used a colored dye in our mostly surrogate amend or tests that we've done so far using surrogate sediments to look at what goes, how we could deliver that. And then moving into the solid amendments, such as powdered activated carbon or the zero-valent iron particles. And just real quick, when we used some of the existing technologies of our water jet laboratory, we had definite concentration limitations of how much we could move in there. So we're looking at essentially a fairly high energy input to pierce through the sediment surface and then reach depth. And to do that, the equipment is essentially designed, in many cases, for water jet cutting technologies, where a very small amount of amendment of a solid garnet or other metals are in the flow, but at a very low concentration. and we're fundamentally looking at the complete opposite. We want to maximize the amount of the particles we can put in place and minimize the amount of water that's going to displace the sediment water and possibly push some of the sediment pore water into the column. So initially we had some problems with the plugging in the start stops using a pulse injection, as we'll show in the first few slides here, and that resulted in damage to the equipment, and essentially new approaches were needed that were not available off the shelf or in our water jet laboratories. And largely what we'll look at today is testing into surrogate sediments. We've used a kaolinite clay as our cohesive sediment, and then a white quartz sand as our non-cohesive sediment, and then we can do very rapid visualization and also quantification of the amendments, mostly based on colorimetric analysis or on quick chemical analysis. So moving on to slide 43, you can see the first pulse shot, and this is done with the existing water jet laboratory approach. A very fine jet is with high energy is shot into it, and we've got a green dye in there, and you can see it reaching to a depth of about 10 inches or 30 centimeters very quickly within this. So these are fractions of a second that you can see on the slide here, and essentially as you move through this, it becomes almost like a flip chart movie, and you can see that we reach the depth, and then a cavity forms where there's the water that was with the amendment is essentially in place there. And the amendment starts to go into place. Again, this is just a dyed liquid that shows the pocket formation. And as the pocket formation of the energy is dissipated, starts to balloon out, at this case at about 20 centimeters depth after the initial depth was reached with the pulse. And after that shut off, you can see the water jet has moved on, and the pocket from the first injection has not collapsed yet, and the second amendment injection has been started, and you can see that the pocket formation starts to develop from the second one, and that we are reaching that at-depth placement of an amendment through the sediment with very little surface disturbance. And moving on there, you can see that the pocket grows within the second injection, and before moving on, this could be repeated on down the path and was, but for the sake of length here, we kept it fairly short in what we're presenting today. So on the, and this was a non-cohesive sediment, a fine-grained white sand that represents the sediment bed in this case, and again, a liquid amendment shown as a dye. And again, when we moved with that exact same setup into granular amendments, we definitely had some plugging problems and equipment. The stop start and the very quick pulsing that was required to get that energy burst down to depth, we could not stop and start especially the iron amendment very well. So we looked at a couple different delivery methods. The equipment essentially was not designed for that, so we looked at new designs of the equipment itself. And one of the methodologies was to use a pneumatic amendment delivery system along with mixing with the water jet at the nozzle itself. So you can see in the excerpt to the top right, there's two different inputs to the nozzle. Side input, or top in this alignment, which will be shown better the next one, brings into it a dry amendment feed along with essentially an air mixing. And then the high-energy water jet enters from the back of the scale there, or the schematic there, and mixes in and then can be injected into the sediment. And that worked quite well at getting very high concentrations into the flow. One of the problems was the three-phase, the amendment solid, the hydraulic liquid, the aqueous part of the mixing, and the air essentially entered more energy than we were hoping to into the system. But we did reach quite good depths with that. The other three methods that you see below that are single pulse method using a slurry of activated carbon is primarily what we've looked at with that, and essentially little bit lower pressure, but the blast essentially dissipates the initial energy, which penetrates to depth, and then follows through with delivery of more of the amendment as the pressure dissipates. And then it can be moved on, essentially as you saw, was observed in the first slide there, moving from one pulse to the next and interlocking them. We've also looked at constant flow nozzles, where we can turn it on and then translate the nozzle itself essentially moving across the surface in one dimension, and reaching depth overall with that. And one of the things we'll show with that is we did not get good mixing. We get a pretty limited distribution with cohesive amendments. And if we go to a fan jet technology, we get rapid energy dissipation and we don't reach our depth. So to try and address that, we went with a dual nozzle system, as you can see in the schematic to the right, where we've got angled injections that cross below the sediment surface or are offset from each other a little bit. And with that approach, we try to minimize the disturbance to the surface again, but yet the crossing jets tend to fan out underneath the surface and reach and result in a better mixing, as we'll show. So now I'm going to go through the three different methodologies, but I wanted to give a comparison initially looking at three things that we have essentially available now and ready for a scale-up in some level. First of all, and I move on now to slide 51, and we can see the pneumatic performance concentration test. So one of the efforts was to try to maximize the percent of the amendment discharge, and that would essentially allow or minimize the amount of displacement we have of the water or the air in this case, since it's pneumatic feed for the amendment into the sediment, and also minimize the mixing while maximizing the delivery. You see on the left table, the pump pressure ranges from 700 psi to 1500 psi, and the percent iron in the discharge started out about 33% and went up to roughly plus 50% plus or minus some variability. And this would be the percent of iron delivered by weight versus the percent of liquid delivered. Obviously, the specific gravity of the iron is much higher, and we can reach fairly high levels there. So this is really outstanding at delivering high concentrations of iron into the sediment. And then at the right, you can see the same type of a setup, obviously with lower pressures. And an interesting thing there is with the lower density powdered activated carbon, we saw the concentration decrease as the hydraulic pressure increased. So in this case, the lower weight activated carbon did not get entrained or did not travel through the pneumatic feed, which was at a set pressure quite as well as we would have hoped. But with that, we went forward and looked at placement into the surrogate sediments, and we needed to quantify then what our placement concentrations were. And we were essentially targeting the same concentrations that Upal was talking about earlier, looking at 1 to 3% in the sediment, or in the terms that he was talking about, 0.5 to 1 or 2% or 1 or 2 times the background organic carbon concentration in the sediment. So if we move on to the powdered activated carbon quantification methods, just so we can explain what we're showing in some of the data slides, we're looking at a radiometer that looks at the reflectance of different wavelengths from the sediment after it's been amended. And from that, we can quantify the amount of carbon that we've placed in different locations very rapidly and get data from our laboratory tests. And then moving on to slide 53, the quantification methods are shown there. Just so we can look at, we're not actually measuring the actual concentration. We're measuring a light emittance from a standard source. And moving on to slide 54, you can see an approach of within a cylindrical sediment column. We can take slices off of the column and then measure at different locations radially out. And you can see a comparison of the samples, A1 through A5. And we compare that to a standard set of samples that we've prepared with different activated carbon concentrations. And you can see this is how we did a very rapid testing within our sediment column that we'll see in a moment. If we move on to slide 55, you can see some of our first data, and this is from the pneumatic feed system, where the pneumatic activated carbon feed was mixed with a high-energy water jet feed at the nozzle and then injected into a column. And you can see the sample location in terms of depth from the bottom up within a column, and with a 5-minute injection at 500 psi, in this case, we could reach a depth of about 8 inches. And one of the issues here is with the high concentration of air in the three-phase mixture of air, amendment, and water. We had a lot of the carbon pushed back up to the surface fairly rapidly, so we had a quick penetration to depth, and then we did not get much more depth after that. Essentially, you can almost think about it as turning into an excavation type of a approach. And you can see the concentrations we reached up to 0.5% or 3% in areas here, but much of the carbon was essentially pushed back to the surface and deposited on the surface after that. And moving on to slide 56, you can see an actual photo cutting out of some of the sections. In this case, we're down to about 15 centimeters depth, and this one was done with an actual slurry injection. And you can see that there was a high concentration of carbon essentially placed as a plug backfilling the initial penetration of the water jet. And this leaves the vein. And this is where the earlier studies in the non-cohesive sediment, the sand, resulted in a lot more mixing. But in this case, the initial penetration cut through the very cohesive sediment and then did not mix much after that point. And that was one of the limitations of the straight jet technology and such. Moving on to slide 57, you can see the iron distribution, and the higher density iron reached a much greater depth. And if you remember from the earlier slides looking at concentration, we had much higher concentrations of the iron, up to 50% by weight in our flow, and that reached a much greater depth into the sediment column and also a wider distribution within that. So we start to see more of the teardrop shape that we were looking to get to, and this was, again, at about 500 PSI. And then you can also see the high concentrations within this one of the surface deposition of the iron as a essentially, we went for a longer injection. At the left, you can see a 30-second injection where it was a very quick pulse relative to the depth we got. And you can see the iron, again, did not deposit on the surface quite as much, but we did get placement down to the depth of the concentrations we were looking at. And this really shows the difference between a low-density solid amendment and a high-density solid amendment. And again, that was powdered activated carbon in the earlier slide and iron in this slide as shown. From that point, we realized somewhat of the limitations of the pneumatic feed system and also the benefits of getting high concentration delivery, but there was a excessive sediment resuspension, just visually determined in this case, that we would like to move away from, and also looked at new technologies for injecting with a slurry of the amendments. So moving on to slide 58, one of the slurry amendment systems that we looked at was a positive displacement pump. Some of the details given here and some of the details of the initial test where we injected a carbon slurry up to 15% carbon by weight, and the slurry could be injected. And again, our surrogate sediment bed was a kaolinite in this case. And at this one, we looked at multiple pulse injections, essentially on a one increment grid, and a burst injection that started at 2500 PSI and would then bleed down to about 700 PSI at a steady state pressure during the flow. And the entire injection was about 5 seconds long. And then the nozzle would be moved to the next injection location. Moving on to slide 59. You can see a little bit of what that profile looks like. There's a little bit of smearing as we've extracted the sample for analysis, but we could achieve over 3% carbon to depth of 20 centimeters, again, using this pulse technology and a bleed off of the energy at a lower pressure for the placement of the carbon once the hole was essentially cut to depth. And again, it's a very cohesive sediment of kaolinite clay. And one of the things we'd like to focus in on here is you can see the injection pattern. This is at depth in the sediment column. And we can see that you can still see right after the amendment distinguishable injection points. which then we'd be looking at natural processes to hopefully homogenize the system a little bit more, and that's where the bioturbation or the natural sediment movement may spread that out a little bit more over time. So this was immediately after that, the injection point. And moving on to a new another technology then for delivering the sediments in place on slide 60, we set up a sediment bed that looks at a constant injection and then translating the water jet at a known speed across the bed and looking at injection. In this case, we can concurrently record any of the turbidity that we see being caused by resuspension of the sediment. We can control the lamp's depth, location, turbidity, pressure, measure turbidity, and monitor the pressure and flow of the amendments over time, and at the same time capture video. A lot of our data, as you can obviously see, is visual at this point, trying to see which methodologies work best. Using this bed, we've had two different delivery systems, one of which you can see somewhat of on the left photo there. The blue pump on the left is an Aquadyne system that we use to burst the slurry concentrations. And at the right, there's one of our off-the-shelf pressure washers, essentially, that we've used to deliver energy flow in a number of the systems, including the pulsed pneumatic system that you saw earlier. Moving on to slide 61, one of the continuous slurry systems that we've utilized for delivering our highest concentration flow yet is a pressure chamber where it's pneumatically pressurized, but the flow is entirely just slurry. So none of the air that's providing the energy to the system is delivered to the system through the nozzle. This has the benefits of there are no moving parts in contact with the slurry itself, so we have very little wear and tear on the equipment, and we can deliver, again, up to 35% powdered activated carbon in the slurry. The pressure we utilized was up to 120 psi, and we didn't want to exceed the safety ratings on the existing system. And this could go considerably higher, but in our laboratory setting, there's a considerable concern for the pneumatic danger of having higher pressure flows, and that's a lot of energy stored in our laboratory system. If we get high pressures within the pneumatic system, it doesn't dissipate as quickly as if we have an aqueous pressurized system. So we've also looked at a progressive cavity pump, which is the model system there that we're using, where we can deliver 8 gallons per minute and up to 1,200 psi in the flow. So considerably higher pressures can be reached with this. And overall, we're looking at this just provides energy to the flow. Whichever field or we scaled up in field testing, we focus on the nozzle design and the delivery system once we have that pressurized flow or energized flow in the system. And you can see moving on to slide 62, some of our cross sections that we've observed. On the left, you can see some smearing in the analysis here, but delivery to depth of the powdered activated carbon in the kaolinite. And on the right, you can see powdered activated carbon essentially delivered into a sediment that was essentially removed from a field setting of, again, a very cohesive sediment that was capped in this case. And on the right, you can see one of the issues we've had with our single jet is that we get excavation of the cohesive sediment, but then no more mixing after that initial essentially mixing into the system or cutting through the cohesive. The underlying forces between the soil particles or the sediment particles maintain the structure of the system and don't allow a great deal of mixing at depth, which is exactly contrary to what we had seen in the non-cohesive sediment where we get a fanning out of the amendment placement at depth. In this case, we see a focusing down, a V-shaped delivery. To help deal with that, we've looked at a system of the dual jet nozzles, where they're essentially cross-firing and the intersection point would be below the existing surface of the sediment. And in this case, you can see the schematic as we showed before and one of our placement profiles. I apologize for not having a scale on the right, but essentially the depth there is 12 inches or a little over 30 centimeters, and the throat at the surface is about 7 inches or a little over 20 centimeters, not quite wide at the throat. And this is in some of our first work. We haven't optimized the system at all. But with this, we can certainly deliver the sediment amendment to a greater depth with the mixing profile that we initially were targeting. And that covers the majority of the methods we've looked at so far. But certainly there's a lot more data there than can be presented in this limited time. But I'd like to move on to some of our sediment approaches where we've used actual contaminated sediment age and looked at bioavailability reductions within the system. So moving on to slide 64, the bioavailability measurements were done with solid phase microextraction fibers, and these are placed with depth into the sediments, and the steamy fibers essentially are a glass core with a polydimethyl silicone coating that allows for direct contact with, in this case, the pore water, and they can equilibrate then, and we can get a very fine detail, 1 centimeter sections is generally what we've shot for, that we can section the steamy fiber and get an in-place bioavailability measurement. And there's been a fair number of literature articles that have looked at how does that relate to bioavailability. So essentially this is a quick test that would get at the same type of numbers that Upal showed before, measuring the impacts of activated carbon, in this case, delivery into a contaminated sediment. And moving on to slide 65, we see one of the profiles of the bioavailability. In this case, we looked at a contaminated sediment with a wide range of PAHs, and the data you see is just for benzoanthracene within that. We injected a 20% weight-by-weight solution of the powdered activated carbon with a 2-minute injection into one of the sediment columns that we showed earlier, and then we measured the bioavailability in the center where we had mixing and then out towards the edge where we did not have mixing and then also had a control sediment core. So these removed sediments from a contaminated area brought into the laboratory for the testing. The steamy fibers were placed, again, near the center at essentially 3 centimeters from the direct center where we knew we had carbon placement, and then out at about 8 centimeters from the center where we did not have good carbon mixing into the system. And bioavailability was tested 10 days after the injection took place, and equilibration of the steamy fiber was 7 days. And you can see at the right the profile there, and what I'd like to draw your attention to is the activated carbon concentrate, or the measurements with the carbon injection at 3.8 centimeters is in blue, and you can only see the blue essentially in the very top sampling point, and a little trace of it down at about 3 centimeters depth. Otherwise, it was essentially non-detect over the whole system, showing more than 99% reduction in bioavailability with this test. And the carbon delivery was estimated, not measured specifically at how much activated carbon there, was estimated at about 3 to 5% of the sediment. And moving on to slide 66 to try and back calculate what that concentration of carbon likely was. We did an activated carbon placement into the contaminated sediment and then looked at the reduction versus the percent activated carbon added, and you can see a drop off there. And this falls right in line with Upal's earlier assessment of how much activated carbon to add, and this was about 1 to 2 times the concentration of the background organic carbon in this sediment, and it was aged again with PAH, so the sediments were highly contaminated, but had been aged, so the bioavailability, or the fraction of the benzoanthracene that was the bioavailability, was fairly small. And you can see a nice relationship. So we were shooting for roughly the 3% carbon in this case to be 1 to 2 times that of the background TOC of the sediment. And that essentially covers the contaminant interactions. And I'd like to move on now to slide 67 and cover the operations, essentially the objectives of the operations. As we're delivering the carbon, nothing has changed from what Upal showed earlier, as far as trying to deliver the carbon to drop the bioavailability of it, or in other cases to deliver perhaps a reactive amendment such as the zero valent iron, or deliver a microbial slurry if we have a microbial population that can help degrade the contaminants in situ. So the other things we're trying to do within our operations is minimize suspension, the potential to place under a cap without disturbing the cap should a sand cap be desired at the site also. And then we wanted to evaluate the benthic impacts of the water jet itself, essentially the placement, not of the activated carbon once in place. Moving on to slide 68, you can see one of our first tests on the turbidity measurements, and the turbidity essentially jumps off the chart as the amendment is taking place. In a very small section of water overlying this sediment. And from a measurement, we could see that we did not have a great mass of the sediment resuspended, but in this case, the turbidity was fairly high. But again, since it wasn't a great mass, it essentially dampened out very quick in an order of minutes, going back to the background turbidity of the system. And we can measure this online as we're injecting with the sediment test system that we have. And next, to move on to slide 69, you can see a cap sediment. Again, this is a field sediment that was moved into the laboratory and then was jetted through. And you can see on the right, post-treatment, that the cap is certainly disturbed, but is still, for the most part, intact. So we jetted through the sediment. A good portion of the sand was pulled down in with the injection process, but the cap integrity overall was still in place. Moving on to slide 70, we can see the sediment was disturbed enough and resuspended to some level and then deposited on the cap. So in this case, it was a 3-inch cap of sand that was then jetted through, and you can see the disturbance in the middle of the slide is greater where the water jet passed over it. And the sediment was, some of it was redeposited. In this photo we're showing here, the sediment was the kaolin, the surrogate sediment, and you can see a good light differential there, a color differential showing essentially some areas with very little deposition, but up to about 7 millimeters in some areas was the maximum deposition. When we actually inject with carbon into the slurry or the kaolin surrogate sediment or into an actual field sediment, a majority of what's redeposited is actually the carbon that's pushed back up as the water is mixed into the sediment and then comes back to the surface. So in a field test, we would expect that while some sediment is resuspended and then deposited, as it's deposited, it's actually mixed with high concentrations of the activated carbon. So we would expect the concentrations to bioavailability concentrations to be fairly low. And that goes right back to Upal's measurements of taking in the activated carbon, mixing it with the sediment, and then feeding it to the clams or to the alligator, small worm, and looking at the concentrations in the worms and the clams after time. And then to measure the direct benthic damage, we looked at passing the water jets over a variety of different organisms, essentially benthic beds, and watching the impacts. And you can see some of the work here to the right, and this was all done by Grace Harper in her lab. And when we passed the water jet, even at a concentration of 1,200 or 1,400 PSI over some mussels, we did not see direct impact to them. But we also wanted to measure what the impact at depth in the sediment would be, so we used essentially some styrofoam blocks, polystyrene, to be our surrogates and see what the damage was within the sediment as we passed the jet over. So moving on to slide 72. You can see a little bit of the profile there at the right, looking at water jet, a very fine jet in this case, at 1,400 PSI, and looking at the depth of the cut into the polystyrene block as a function of the depth in the sand. So the polystyrene blocks were very different depths in the sand. And then you can see essentially an exponential drop-off with depth of the cut, into the sand depth as the energy is dissipated as the jet penetrates the sand. And in this case, the water jets are essentially not focused at the depth if there's a sand overlaying the polystyrene block, and we'd see essentially no damage to the polystyrene at a depth of 4 centimeters into the sand. And then at the bottom, you can see the depth of the cut and the polystyrene dropped off quickly. If we just had the height of the nozzle above into the water setting, so the mixing within the water also dissipated the energy very quickly. But again, that would limit the depth of the placement we could get. And overall, one of the benefits is we're looking at a surface disturbance of less than about 15% to have the sediment placement. So we wouldn't expect a large impact to a broad population since we're not disturbing the entire surface. And then that brings us to our next test, which is on slide 73, where we looked at live tests with Azteca and with sea tentons, and we looked at the impact to them growing the organisms up, placing them in a sediment bed, and then passing the water jet over the top. And in this case, we were doing 800 PSI, translating the water jet over the surface. And you can see there one of the organisms being found after the test. And the viability of the organisms was observed using microscopy to look at the survival. Moving on to slide 74, you can see the overall data from the tests that we've done to date with the Azteca in the top slide. And essentially two tests were run and with 30 organisms and with 20 organisms in a fairly small bed. And you can see post-injection out of the 30 organisms, 21 were alive, 2 were dead within the decanted water. So many of them were suspended into the water column. And on the sand itself, 6, so only one was not counted in the first test, was alive. And then an hour and a half later, we looked at was there a mortality to the organism with time. And again, the numbers were just the same. And then in another test, that was run, 20 organisms were placed into the bed, and you can see that they were all counted back, and that in one of the tests we did have 6, mortality of 6 out of the 20 over an hour and a half period after the test. And then with the Tentons organism, looking at the right there, the bloodworm, you can see that 2 tests were run with 20 and 10 organisms, and that there was a little greater mortality to them in the first test within that case. But overall, there was good survivability of the organism, and this is nothing to do with the toxicity of the sediment. This is the actual water jet or the amendment placement technology and what the impact to the benthic organisms was. So overall, and to wrap things up here and get everybody on their way, in summary, we definitely looked at different amendments, and on to slide 75, I should note. Can be delivered by a variety of methods. Within these methods, it'd be site-specific or sediment-specific due to the cohesive nature of the existing sediment and what the amendment was that was to be delivered. Using our slurry systems, up to 35% carbon, which is, to date, and you saw from a lot of UPAL's work, probably the most widely used amendment, we can do up to 35% within the pneumatic systems or the slurry systems. And the positive displacement pumps operate best at about 15 to 20% in the amendment slurry that we're looking at. We can easily reach depths of 20 to 30 centimeters. And with the dual nozzles, we really haven't pushed how deep we can go, but 30 centimeters is not pushing the technology as it's currently developed. We certainly can go deeper, but with the more energy we deliver to go at deeper depths, the greater impact we'd have on the benthic community and the greater resuspension we'd expect, which is one thing we're trying to minimize. So as this moves forward into a field applicable technology, we'd really like to look at that and see how we can dial in and deliver the minimum amount of energy to reach the depth of interest. And moving on to slide 76, resuspension was substantial with the pneumatic system, and with the dual nozzle system it was decreased considerably to reach the same depth, and then you can see the results essentially pulled right off of the benthic organism study that was just shown. So in the sake of time, I'll jump over that, get right on to the acknowledgments. I'd like to acknowledge again NIHS for funding this work. Dr. Honglan, she and her lab did a lot of the assistance with the analytic technology. And you saw quite a bit of going from zero to many systems at our disposal, our capability, and that was due to our technical staff down below and some of the other graduate students that helped in on this but weren't directly related. And with that, I think we have a few minutes left for answering some questions.
Yeah, we do. Thank you, Dr. Brogan. But I've got a lot of questions here submitted online. I'm sure there's a lot of questions on the phone, so we're going to run out of time at 4 o'clock before all the questions are answered, so I want to go with administrative questions first. Now, certainly, any questions that you have, either online or on the phone, that have not had time to address, feel free to send an email to either presenter, and I'm surely more than glad to answer your questions. Right, guys?
Of course.
Of course. A couple things. You know, the last slide here, please check out the additional resources webpage. There's other information on these technologies. And if you have time, please complete the feedback form because we're always looking for how to improve these webinars. The last thing I want to mention is there's going to be another Clue-In webinar a week from today, next Wednesday, 2 o'clock, where the Superfund Research Program is going to talk about current funding opportunities, especially for the universities that are looking for new grants, the bigger grants. So you can go on the website, get information there, register for that seminar, and I think it'd be useful. Okay, now we'll go back to take a couple questions for Dr. Brogan first from the phone. Okay, well, Joel, I got one here online, and I'll read that to you, and you can address that one. This is from Mary Logan, who's an RPM and EPA in Region 5. Her question has to do with slide number 65. The concentration in pore water at 7.6 centimeters away from injection was higher at most depths from 11 to 25 centimeters. Could this be a result of displacement of pore water by the injection? If so, any feel for how far the displacement went?
That's a really good question, and we've not determined that specifically. Our thought is that the injection process essentially abraded and broke up the sediment at a very fine level. We tried to take the sediment and move it into the columns without great disturbance, and when we had the long-term injection, we did see higher concentrations, and not all tests, but in many, and it could be due to just heterogeneities in the sediment as we collected it, but that didn't seem to be it, is that we may actually increase outside of the carbon area the bioavailability just by physically disturbing the system with the water jet. So it's a very good question. We've had the same question ourselves, and we don't see that in all of our tests. It's just a sample of the data so far. But that would be our hypothesis at this point that's yet untested.
Okay, great. Thanks. Okay. We'll take some additional questions from the phone for either presentation. Feel free to go ahead. Okay, well, I'll go back to the online questions then. Rupal, I got one for you here from Chris McInnes, Department of Natural Defense in Ottawa. Question is, if I understand correctly, the contaminated sediment remaining below the layer of carbon-amended sediment stays contaminated, and you are just limiting the availability of uptake of contaminated sediments by organisms. Is that correct?
That is right. The treatment is designed to the zone that has influence in bio-uptake into organisms and transfer into the food chain. And there can be some debate in terms of what that zone is. And that also relates to a previous question we had about saturation of the carbon. So the current thinking, or maybe our thinking, is that if you know what that bioactive zone is, which is the zone that's influencing uptake into the food chain, then that's the zone that needs to be treated with a strong solvent to reduce uptake in the food chain. And that's assuming that the sediments don't get turned over and the top sediment become bottom sediment and the contaminant sediments come up and lie on the top due to some kind of a major event that takes place. So So that is correct, that the treatment is designed for a zone that we think would be responsible in the future for uptake in the food chain, which is somewhere in the top several inches.
Okay, thank you. Another question was submitted is from Andres Martinez, University of Iowa, Iowa City. Question is, this is for you, Yuval.
Okay.
Is it possible that activated carbon could be degraded or transformed into dissolved organic carbon and then increase the concentration of dissolved organic carbon in the sediment pore water, and then the contaminants partition into the DOC and then move from the sediment pore water to the water column, increasing the flux of contaminants from the sediment to the overlying water? Any comments?
Sure, that's a good question, and that's something that one has to be very careful about in terms of selecting amendments that go into sediments to sequester any contaminant. And from what we know, theoretically, the activated carbon is not degraded in the environment. The black carbon from the it's primarily a graphitic form of carbon. It's not degraded in the environment to cause abundance of either dissolved organic carbon of some form that could take the contaminants up through the pore water. The other thing is the studies that we have done in the field or in the lab over the long period of time of up to 3 to 4 years do not indicate that. So based on what we know theoretically and observations that we are making from the field, we have no reason to believe that activated carbon can break down into dissolved organic carbon that can enhance transfer.
Thank you. Okay, time for one last general question that either of you can address. The last question has to do with, can activated carbon be used for heavy metal remediation in sediment?
Yeah, that's something that we are looking at right now, and we know that among the heavy metals, mercury adsorbs very strongly to activated carbon, and that has led us to lab studies and field studies that are going on in the field, and if you're interested, you should probably attend the talk, the webinar that's going to be given by Charlie Menzi, I think in January, where he'll be presenting some of the data on mercury adsorption of carbon and reduction in mercury and methylmercury bioavailability in using activated carbon in sediments. So that we have, but for some of the other heavy metals, it depends on the heavy metal. Some heavy metals adsorb to activated carbon, some don't, and there are some specialized activated carbons that have been put together which have stronger adsorption capability for heavy metals that we are looking at. So I would say that for mercury and methylmercury, we know activated carbon works, and certain grades of activated carbon work better than others. But for a range of other heavy metals, we are also looking at other types of adsorbents that are suitable for the heavy metal.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, so I'm not going to be able to address the other questions. I want to thank both presenters for their excellent presentation, for time they spent sharing information with us. And again, if you have additional questions, please send them to the email that you got on the website, and hope to hear from you on the next webinars. Thank you very much.